Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, we're focusing on Republicans in the House of Representatives and what they hope to achieve in this 118th Congress. They have a slim majority, and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will need to keep all his members on board to pass the bills they want. But what are those bills? For that, let's turn to GOP Congressman Gary Palmer. He represents Alabama's 6th Congressional District, and he's chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee. He joins me from the Capitol. Congressman Palmer, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Kimberly.
So are all of the committees up and running at this point as the 118th Congress is underway?
I beg your pardon, ask that question again.
Yes, are all the committees in the House, are they up and running?
I'm not sure about the other committees. I know Energy and Commerce will be holding hearings next week. I'm not sure that the Democrats have populated all of their committees yet.
Okay. Well, explain for our listeners what your responsibilities are as chairman of the House Policy Committee.
Well, primarily, we're pushing out ideas, but we're also trying to make sure that all of our members are informed about all of the issues that we're addressing. And one of the things that happens when you get in Congress is you get on a committee and you sort of get siloed, and you might not know, you might be on the ag committee but might not know what's going on financial services. Or and what we try to do is make sure that everybody is fully informed, and we also do analysis of issues, almost operate like a think tank within the conference to make sure that our members have good material, reliable material that's all fact checked, and that they know how to discuss these issues when they go home.
Okay. I want to get into some of the legislation that you and your colleagues will be offering this session. Congressman Steve Scalise had said that there would be ready-to-go legislation right at the start, but there are some bills that have run into a bit of a stumbling block. GOP Congressman Tony Gonzalez of Texas pushed back on the border security legislation, for example, saying, quote, "I'm focused on delivering tangible and timely results, not getting weighed down by messaging bills that have no chance of being signed into law." Here's what he said to the ABC affiliate in Dallas.
We have a divided government, but I think there's opportunities, though, in divided government, opportunities to solve real problems. But it starts with people that are willing to have policy conversations and not rhetoric. Honestly, I'm concerned with what we're going to see in the next week or two with this Border Safety and Security Act. And to me, this is a piece of legislation that really bans all asylum claims, to include legal asylum claims.
Congressman Palmer, what are the issues surrounding that piece of legislation directed at the border?
Well, obviously, Tony has some issues with it, but we'll work these out. I think what the American people need to understand about the border is that border security has now become national security. And there may be some disagreement about on asylum seekers, but the real issues with the border are we don't know who's coming across in terms of the gotaways. We do know that there's a number that's probably classified of people who are affiliated with terrorist organizations. And then you've got the fentanyl problem. We had over 107,000 people die from drug overdoses last year. So it's almost like we've gone from a war on drugs to a war with drugs. So I would say that the American people are beginning to understand that border security is not just about whether or not people come over here to find a job, but it has become a national security issue.
Congressman, there are people both in your party and among Democrats who put border security as a priority. Is there a concern that the inability so far to come to some consensus within your own caucus will make it even harder to try to pass something that could get some sort of bipartisan support?
I don't think so. I think the real issue is what's going on with the Biden administration and their failure to uphold the laws that we already have on the books, and have the Secretary of Homeland Security mislead Congress about what's going on, mislead the American people. And I think it's becoming more and more apparent to the American people what's really happening down there, and that the Biden administration is not upholding the law, not fulfilling its constitutional duty to protect the homeland.
What are some of the other top priorities as you see it for this Congress this session?
Well, we just saw where real hourly wages for all employees are down 1.7% over the last year. And that's largely because of inflation. Even though we had a good quarter, 2.9 growth in GDP, all of the signs are pointing toward a recession. And I think we've got to really work on bringing down the cost of living for Americans. It's a combination of things. It's the excessive spending of the Biden administration in the first 2 years. It's their really harmful energy policies. Energy is a major driver of inflation because there's an energy cost in every good and service that you and I consume. And then the regulatory cost. And people may not realize this, but in Biden's first year in office, he increased regulatory costs three times more than what Obama did in his first year in office, over $200 billion. So that's just that alone adds about $1,500, a little over $1,500 per household in regulatory costs.
So let's talk about another piece of must-pass legislation, and that involves the debt ceiling. Why not go for a grand bargain commission to work things out, as Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has suggested? By not doing that, is that putting the economy at risk?
Well, we're going to deal with the debt limit if the president will come to the table and negotiate. I appreciate Manchin's efforts, but I think President Biden has taken a very arrogant position that he won't talk to the legislative branch, and in some respects has just abandoned the American people on this issue. The sooner he comes to the table, I think the quicker we'll come to a resolution.
Do you think that a resolution is possible? What do you think are, explain for our listeners what the major sticking points are at this point?
Well, I think we've got to deal with the spending. We can't keep spending the way we are and continue to add to our debt. You know, just 4 or 5 years ago, the debt to GDP was probably around 70-80%. Now we're at over 120%. And we're mortgaging the future of the country at an unprecedented rate. So I think the White House has got to come to the table. The House and Senate have got to work together, and we've got to figure out a way to bring down the spending, get to a balanced budget over time. And it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be sensible.
And so there is a question as to this, the GOP's opposition to spending and putting that in the debate about the debt limit, which is really about what Congress has already spent, has turned this into yet another messaging bill. What do you say to that?
I don't think it's going to be a messaging bill. And I think there needs to be messaging about what's going on with our fiscal future. And I mean, we cannot continue to pay people not to work when you have the labor demands that we have. We're literally taking, borrowing money against our children's future to undermine the economy that they're going to grow up in, undermine their future, and continue to support people who refuse to go to work.
So I want to talk a little bit about the politics of this. Do you believe that Freedom Caucus members are disrupting Speaker McCarthy's ability to lead and your party's plans to legislate?
I haven't seen that.
So do you think that?
I think we're working together well right now.
So is that part of the reason why we have seen some of these bills that were expected to go to the floor very quickly hit some stumbling blocks and not get there? Is that not part of the intra-party disagreements that are going on?
Well, this Republican conference, this Republican majority is different from anything anyone's seen in decades. This is not a top-down run organization. We're getting input from everybody, and we want that input. I was talking to one of the freshman members this morning about how impressed I am with the intellectual ability of these freshman members, the expertise and the experience that they're bringing to the table. And I think anyone who's in management wants to take advantage of the assets that they've been given, and we've been given a lot of assets, and we're going to take advantage of them. So it won't be a top-down management style.
Okay. Congressman, I want to ask you if you and others who in 2021 objected to the certification of some electoral votes, if that makes it harder for you to work with the White House now that Republicans are in control of the House or to work with your Democratic colleagues?
I think what makes it difficult to work with the White House is how extreme they are in their agenda. There's a clear line of difference between what they believe and what we think is best for the American public, whether it's economic policy, foreign policy, energy policy in particular, and the spending. And I think that's what makes it difficult, and especially when you have a president that says that he's not going to negotiate on something as important as the debt limit.
All right. Congressman Gary Palmer of Alabama, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Kimberly.
When we come back, more on the internal dynamics of the House GOP and how they hope to come together to pass legislation in the next 2 years. I'm Kimberly Akinstor. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkinstor. We're talking about the House GOP and what it hopes to achieve in the next 2 years. To do that, I'm joined by Scott McFarlane, congressional correspondent for CBS News, and Philip Wallach, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and an expert on Congress and the administrative state. They're both joining me from Washington. Philip and Scott, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here, Kimberly.
So, Scott, I want you to react to what Congressman Palmer has just told us and where the GOP is at this moment when it comes to trying to pass important pieces of legislation.
This feels unequivocally like a fragile moment, really, for any House majority where the margin of error is so small, where any four or five members of the Republican conference, in essence, have veto power, can block or kill any legislation they don't support. Congressman Palmer, I think among many important things he just said, used a phrase that I underlined in my notebook when asked about messaging bills, saying they're not messaging bills to him. And that's going to be really the bottom line of this entire Congress for this Republican conference. So much of what they pass won't see the light of day in the U.S. Senate. So it's easy to characterize them as messaging bills, things that their House Republicans want to be heard on. But if they don't view them that way, if they view these bills as vital, that indicates where we're headed. with the potential of standoffs and a lack of cobbling together, Kimberly, a coalition of Republicans and Democrats to do big things or get actual law passed.
Yeah. And Philip, let's talk about that coalition. This Congress started where we saw the Freedom Caucus members making it difficult for Speaker McCarthy to even get the gavel. But since then, we've seen some of the fractions happen in other places within this caucus. Is this party as divided, or at least this caucus as divided as it seems from the outside looking in?
Well, I think it's really hard, and we look at Democrats in the last Congress had a similar margin in the House, but they were able to stay exceptionally unified in passing a lot of bills. And I don't think there's any reason to think that Republicans can achieve that degree of unity. So that just means that they have to go for a bipartisan approach, as much as they might like to get some things through. For the sake of communicating with the American people what their party is about ahead of the 2024 election. When it comes to legislating, they just don't have any other choice but to work with Democrats. And so, you know, that means that actually five Republican votes, whoever you want to choose them from, aren't as important as they sometimes seem, because they really are going to have to find a way to bring in decent numbers of Democrats to move legislation.
So, Scott, I mean, to that point about the way Democrats, despite their own internal differences, they were able to unite in order to pass bills. Do you see Republicans working their way to being able to do that as well, or have these early efforts to try to pass the border bill, for example, or the prosecutor's bill that would have required local prosecutors to disclose which cases they declined to pursue? If these early indications that Republicans won't have that kind of unity, or is this just them getting started and trying to figure out how they work together?
Yeah, they're getting started. And excuse any new party in power for some bumps in the road in the first few days, because they're organizing their committees. They're still figuring out who sits where, who's going to be on which panel. There's going to be some growing pains. I think it's going to be helpful to think of two separate buckets of legislation. One big bucket of things that the Republicans would like to pass, but likely have little prospect of passing, but things that maybe they'll give a fighting chance to. Then there's this other small bucket, but this small bucket's got the valuable stuff in it. This is the bucket of things that must pass. You have to get done or government fails. Think about the debt ceiling. Government spending. You have to pass appropriations bills or the federal government shuts down. They turn off the lights and send home federal workers and close federal facilities. The FISA bill. They have to each year authorize intelligence and surveillance. And they have to pass a farm bill this year. And they have to authorize the military. How do those things get done? I think Philip is spot on. There's likely going to be an inevitability. I should say that. There's going to be an inevitability here that some coalition, a unique, politically complex coalition of Democrats and Republicans will have to get together to pass these things. But the tricky part, Kimberly, is how do you get these bipartisan bills or these bipartisan efforts on the floor? Can Kevin McCarthy do that without either losing his speakership or losing his followers in his conference?
So there have been some bills that have been passed in this House. For example, the IRS funding bill, also the Abortion Survivors Protection Act. They were passed on a straight party line vote, Philip. These bills have no chance in the Democratic-controlled Senate. So what do they mean? What does it mean that they were able to pass these things? Are they just messaging?
Well, listen, it's not as if this is a Republican tendency, right? If you look at the 117th House or the 116th House, both of which were controlled by Democrats, they passed lots and lots of bills that they knew had very little chance of passing. You know, that's especially true when Donald Trump was still in the White House. So this is something both parties do, and it's a legitimate thing to do. It wanted to define their party for the voters, and so they passed these things that take a stand. So on Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, you know, they're trying to show the American people that they're the party who wants to be the party of life, and they've passed this bill on a party line. It's not that hard to get their members aboard on that, because the Republican brand is already associated so strongly with being pro-life, being anti-abortion. So that's not that hard. As they get into more challenging things, like making the Hyde Amendment permanent, you know, the details likely may matter more, even though that's likely not going to happen. But we actually should remember, they've also passed some bipartisan enactments already. These tend to be the things that are a little less sexy, less front page news, but they're happening. And you know, it's kind of a shame that in defining the political dynamic of this Congress, we always just want to think about what are the Democrats and Republicans going to tear each other's throats out about. But there actually are plenty of things that we should expect Democrats and Republicans should be able to work together on.
All right. And we will talk more about how Republicans and Democrats could work together a little later in the show. But I want to turn now from talking about what bills are being proposed and passed to talk a little bit about how they're being proposed and passed. And in one way, we have the Open Amendment, which has come back. Here is House Majority Leader Steve Scalise on Wednesday saying the GOP is bringing back the so-called Open Amendment process for debating bills in the House.
We wanted to jettison the approach that Speaker Pelosi took, where she shut down the ability for even committee chairs to be involved in addressing problems. Bills were written out of her office, not allowing rank-and-file members the ability to have an input in how the process works. And so this week you're going to see another example of us opening things up, an open rule, something we haven't seen in 7 years here in Congress.
And Scott, we have seen that taking place in action this week. Explain this a little more.
Oh, this is my favorite topic. You ever go to one of those work meetings, you know, at the end of the day, and it goes on way too long and everybody has their hand up and you just wish the thing would end so you could go home and have dinner? This is the legislative equivalent of that. They've opened the amendment process, and there was a reason it wasn't open, because this makes simple bills or other low octane bills marathon political theater. And what this does is gives people on the House floor the ability to offer amendments without a limit. And every member of Congress has to wait for the amendment process to end before they can vote and close things up and go home for the weekend. It's terribly democratic. It's what some of the people who held off their votes for Kevin McCarthy to be speaker, it's what some of those Republicans who wouldn't vote for Kevin McCarthy earlier this month were trying to negotiate a procedure that was more open, that would let more people sit in the chamber for longer periods of time, to kind of hit in your mind's eye the more ideal version of democratic debate. But it could go on for a while, and it's like the legislative equivalent of, this could have been an email. We didn't need to have a meeting over this, and that's reality. For now, we'll see if they let this go the whole Congress.
Philip, what do you see as the advantages and disadvantages to this open amendment process?
Okay, well, this is a really big deal. You know, you heard Congressman Palmer talking about this Congress going to work in a very different way. It's not going to be run top down nearly as much. It's going to be soliciting input from everybody. And one of the ways it's going to do that is through actually letting members come to the floor and offer amendments. And that could be tedious. That could sometimes mean that members are spending their time voting on things that don't have a prayer of passing. But guess what? They're legislators. That's their job. I'm not that concerned about whether they can go home for the weekend. You know, if the members themselves want to create a culture where they're actually spending more time in the House chamber debating policy substance, offering alternatives, voting on them, that seems like a very healthy development to me. And it means that we really don't know where bills are going to end up in the end a lot of the time. That it's not just a matter of the leadership mapping everything out in advance and figuring out where we're going to end up. It really is an exploratory process. That's through deliberation going to figure out what a majority coalition can support.
Scott, you mentioned that this open amendment process was one of the sticking points for the members of the caucus who withheld initially their support for Speaker McCarthy. Do we have any indication so far about what else might have been promised to them in order to get to those votes? That was a big question that took place right after that, ever since that 15th ballot in which he finally got the gavel.
It seems they were wise enough not to put too much on paper, because things on paper circulate and they circulate outside of the circle. But this really speaks to the spirit of what that group was trying to negotiate or exact as a concession out of Kevin McCarthy. Things that, to a degree, defang the leadership. This open amendment process, as Philip mentions, really, it makes a more decentralized legislative process where it's not just handed down from above. It's not just leaders instilling their will on members of Congress. And as a congressional reporter, I adore this new process because it keeps members of Congress here in Washington longer. It makes less predictable the debate, the things that are said. It's a reporter's dream. But in terms of what this group was trying to get out of Kevin McCarthy, this really speaks to it. They, among other things, also made it simpler for members of the House to remove the speaker if they so fit to do so. And they've empowered the rank and file in smaller, more incremental ways. That seems to be the spirit of what they were trying to do, was give Kevin McCarthy the speakership, but take away a lot of the authority and power of the speakership.
That's interesting. As a former congressional reporter who, when I was there, you rarely saw a lawmaker there on a Friday, I can, let alone get one for an interview, I could appreciate some of those differences. But to this point, Philip, about this vote of no confidence rule, the one that requires only one member to bring that to a vote, what do you think about that? Does that give the Freedom Caucus a much greater authority over the way Kevin McCarthy governs?
Okay, so that's this motion to vacate the chair, and it's basically the ability to demand a kind of no confidence vote in the speaker. But I think people are overestimating a little bit just how effective it is. It's true that now, according to the changes in the rules that they agreed to and have now made part of the rules, any member of the majority party can bring a motion to vacate the chair, and that will demand that the House take a vote. So that certainly is, a difference from how things were under Nancy Pelosi, but it's going back to the way things were earlier under earlier Republican speakers. But what happens then? Well, they have to take a vote, and they need 218 votes to oust Kevin McCarthy from the speakership. And I think a lot of people are imagining that that would just mean a replay of what happened earlier in January. But that's not so clear, because it's not clear that Democrats would all just be delighted to vote for ousting the speaker so that we could have another knockdown, drag-out speakership fight, especially if Freedom Caucus folks were angry about Kevin McCarthy being too reasonable with Democrats, essentially. Maybe all the Democrats won't be so eager to see him voted out in favor of some other Republican member. So I think this vote would be deeply, deeply embarrassing for McCarthy and Republicans. They certainly don't want to see it happen, and so they need to try to conciliate all of their members, keep them on board so they don't exercise this option. But it's not clear that it means that they can actually kick him out so easily.
So, Scott, I'm looking at a headline bulletin here that key Republicans oppose the House GOP bill to abolish the tax code, another roadblock in these ready-to-go bills, so-called ready-to-go bills that were supposed to be put forward. Do you think that this, you said this is just the caucus, getting started, figuring things out. Do you think there is any concern within the caucus that, this could go badly and that they really need to find a way to sort of coalesce and not have these battles play out in public the way they are?
Yeah, a lot of Democrats think, Kimberly, that they have laid an effective trap for the new House Republican majority. And the debt ceiling is one example of that. Senate Democrats, House Democrats, and even the Senate Republicans have all said now, House Republicans, you go first. What's your plan for raising the debt ceiling? What, put on paper or put on the House floor, your idea of what needs to get done before the debt ceiling is raised. And get yourself 218 votes in the House first, then we'll all respond. And that's tricky on so many different levels, because that means House Republicans would have to propose some form of spending cuts. That's what they're insisting on. They'd have to put on paper or put on the floor specific cuts to specific things. You know what? Spending cuts, Kimberly, aren't terribly popular when people realize a government program might go away.
We're going to hold you right there. We're talking about the Republican majority in the House and challenges they face to get their legislative agenda passed. And when we come back, we will talk more about how they might or might not work with the Democratic minority and President Biden to do the people's business. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Next week, we're going to be talking about Mormon women, the recent murder of a Utah woman and her five children has sparked a conversation about power, vulnerability, and safety for women within the LDS community. Are you a current or former LDS member? How do you feel about the way women are treated? What do you think about the church's role in protecting women and children? Share your experience by recording a message with the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps, or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about the House GOP and what they hope to achieve in the next 2 years. My guests are Philip Wallach, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Scott McFarlane, Congressional Correspondent for CBS News. So, Scott, you started by talking about the fragile situation that Republicans are in. Do you think that makes it more likely or less likely that they will be able to reach across the aisle?
Makes more necessary for them to reach across the aisle for those things they have to do this year, not the things they want to do, the things they have to do. It's far from clear if there are 218, the necessary number of Republican votes to pass raising the debt ceiling, keeping the federal government from shutting down, authorizing the military, and doing the things they have to do, things they have no choice but to get passed. Lest the government collapse. So there's going to be some world in which they need Democratic votes. But there's this dueling interest going on. There are moderates. There are members of the Problem Solvers Caucus who look for ways to work across the aisle, who want to find unique coalitions to get things passed. But then there are others who don't want to extend branches to the Democratic Party for any number of reasons, political and otherwise, who may not let those things come to the floor. So that's where the rubber hits the road in this Congress, and that's why there's so much uncertainty, and that is part of having such a narrow majority. You know, we became accustomed to Nancy Pelosi navigating a similar majority last Congress. The Democrats had almost just as narrow a majority as Republicans have this Congress. She was able to, you know, cover those tracks or bridge across those divides so masterfully, we almost forget how difficult it is to do. That's the reality for Republicans. Some want to work with Democrats, some don't, and there's just no margin for error.
And we've already seen some evidence of some who don't want to work with at least some specific Democrats. Kevin McCarthy has blocked three Democrats from their committee seats, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell from the House Intelligence Committee, and Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee. McCarthy said he removed Congresswoman Omar because of a past remark about pro-Israel American Jews having an allegiance to a foreign nation. She later apologized for saying that, but at a press conference on Wednesday said that McCarthy is using her past comment merely as a pretext.
It is not the accusations that McCarthy is making against us that is pushing for our removal from these committees. It is about revenge. It's about the appeasing the former president. All three of us have been a thorn in the back of the previous disgraced president.
Philip, do you think that this move out of the gate makes it more difficult to work with Democrats?
Well, listen, the relations between the two parties are not good right now. There's really no question about that. And, the Congresswoman's assertion that this is revenge is probably fair. It's revenge not necessarily for being a thorn in Trump's side, but for kicking off Republican members from their committees in the previous Congress that Republicans felt was inappropriate. They made it pretty clear at the time that if that was the road that we were going to go down, that they would have some people that they would be kicking off as well. So I think this is tit for tat. That doesn't make it a particularly healthy development for the institution. That's what it is. And now, whether that means they just can't work together on anything, I don't think so. There can be quite a lot of bad feelings between negotiating partners who still nevertheless sit down across the table and work something out. And I think that's the thing to remember is, as Scott has said, there's just a lot of need to pass kind of stuff. And the way that Congress has worked in recent years, with as much enmity as there has been between the two parties, they get together on these need-to-pass bills. The appropriations bills, the National Defense Authorization Act, they tend to pass with like 300 or 350 votes in the House. So that means that somehow the enmity gets put aside when it really matters the most.
So, Scott, you spoke yesterday with the top Republican and the top Democrat on the Problem Solvers Caucus. Can you explain to us what that is and what did they tell you?
Yeah, I've been seeking this out ever since the Congress began. If you are going to a Broadway show and you have one of those yellow playbills that has the whole cast of characters, you go down halfway down the page of Congress's version of the playbill, and there's a name, Brian Fitzpatrick of suburban Philadelphia, a Republican from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I circled his name metaphorically and put a highlighter through it as well. That's the guy to watch this Congress. Brian Fitzpatrick was the only Republican, the only one, on the Capitol steps 2 weeks ago, on January 6, 2023, for a vigil marking the U.S. Capitol insurrection. The only Republican who showed. He leads the House Problem Solvers Caucus, this group of dozens of Republicans and Democrats, the rosters evenly split, looking for compromise, looking for paths forward to get things done. Brian Fitzpatrick was part of the backroom discussions to end the prolonged marathon speaker vote standoff. He was there either smoothing edges or helping the talks move forward. Look for him to be a pivotal player moving forward. The House Problem Solvers Caucus has been around a while. It's necessarily evenly split. Equal number of Republicans, equal number of Democrats. They have bylaws where they have to support each other, not challenge each other, and look for ways to make legislation more realistic. That's a group that has outsized influence when you have a majority with only four votes to spare. So watch him, watch what he does, watch what he proposes. He'd be a Republican who has some concept of new gun control reform legislation. May not be popular throughout his whole conference, but he'd be a bridge to make those types of things happen.
And Philip, how effective can the problem solvers caucus be when you have the Freedom Caucus among the GOP caucus, and you also have the most progressive members of the Democratic caucus? How difficult will their job be in this session?
Well, the question is floor access that Scott talked about before. What can actually get to the floor? So it's all very well and good to put together a bill that you think could get broad bipartisan support, even if it might lose some support from the most extreme on the left and right. But it's another thing to secure time to consider that bill on the floor and get it through the House. A lot of bills that seem like they ought to be popular can just languish and die without ever having been considered. So, you know, I think we have to see how this new process works in the House with under the McCarthy speakership and this potentially much less top-down process. We need to see whether people who are championing bipartisan initiatives feel that they have good opportunities to advance their legislation. Now, you asked about the Freedom Caucus and whether they might potentially be an obstacle to that kind of bipartisanship. You have to remember, mm-hmm. there's a lot of bills that pass with 400 votes and the Freedom Caucus voting no. They're not ultimately so pivotal on a lot of matters. They can vote no, and the bill just goes through very easily anyway. So the Freedom Caucus can't stop anything all by themselves, but the question is how much McCarthy feels that he needs to respect their preferences when it comes to controlling floor access. So they've talked this big game about openness, and that ought to mean that popular proposals ought to get a hearing on the floor, but we'll have to see how that plays out in practice.
All right, I want to talk about some of the must-pass legislation, including addressing the debt ceiling. Tom Emmer of Indiana is the House Majority Whip, and at a press conference on Wednesday, he said the GOP is ready to negotiate with President Biden and House Democrats on raising the debt limit in return for budget cuts.
Republicans ran and won in 2022 on reining in reckless federal spending. So we're ready to negotiate. It would be a grave mistake for Democrats and the man in the Oval Office to dig their heels in on such an important issue. It's time for Joe Biden to come to the bargaining table. It's responsible, it's sensible, and it's reasonable.
Scott, just like we heard Congressman Palmer say, he wanted the president to come to the table. But when we're talking about cuts, spending cuts, what kind of cuts are members of the GOP caucus talking about?
If only they'd specify more granularly what cuts they have in mind. It's clearly been part of the political messaging this week for the House Republicans to make clear they don't want to cut Social Security. They don't want to cut Medicare. So they have specified emphatically what they don't want to cut. What do you want to cut that can make a sizable difference in the national debt? There are some programs the federal government operates which may be unpopular, maybe. They may be hard to explain, so easier to defend cutting. But those are not the things that make a sizable impact on the national debt. Those are things that, you know, barely trim around edges. So what Democrats are doing here is putting Republicans on the spot. You name the cuts. You tell us what you don't want to give American taxpayers, and you explain it, because odds are there's going to be some political pain to telling people they can't get something anymore, especially things that are sizable, that would make a meaty difference when it comes to the national debt. That's the corner from which Republicans will have to extricate themselves if they truly want to insist on spending cuts. I spoke to one member of the House Freedom Caucus, Andy Harris of Maryland, who talked about maybe repurposing or getting rid of some of the COVID aid money that is still out there in the ether, or some of the COVID-infused spending for some federal programs like SNAP, food stamps. That could make some difference in federal spending, but that's certainly not a long-term way of cutting the national debt unless it's supplemented with other things from other members. So Democrats put Republicans on the spot, and it's going to be fascinating over the next few months to see how they handle that.
All right, Philip, I have a tough question for you. Can you predict how this debt ceiling crisis will ultimately be resolved?
Whew, that is a tough one. I feel more confident in predicting that it will be resolved than in knowing how. You know, it really is not in anybody's political interest to see the United States default on its debt or to miss any of its obligated payments of any kind. There are some members who talk about it as if somehow it would be okay, but those members are really a very small handful. And I think the overwhelming majority, including of House Republicans, understand that the default is just a bad thing, and getting that hung around your neck politically would be disastrous. So I think before June, we're going to see some kind of resolution worked out. There's a couple different ways that it could go. One is some kind of serious policy-based deal between the White House and House Republicans. And that would likely look like something like the 2011 deal between Barack Obama and John Boehner, where there was a framework put in place for spending caps to cap discretionary spending over the ensuing decade. I think there's a lot of Republicans looking to revive something like that. And so perhaps that could be the basis for a bipartisan deal. If the White House really takes a much harder line on not negotiating, or those negotiations don't work out, then I think we could start to think about ways that a majority of members of the House of Representatives could push through an increase in the debt ceiling that most Republicans would be against. So how could we get Republicans to get rolled, essentially? How could we get that bill onto the floor and considered and passed, even though most members of the majority party doesn't want it to? And there's a few different ways that could happen. A discharge petition is one way that people have been talking about, but there are some more obscure parliamentary tactics that could be used that probably make more sense.
So, Scott, away from the floor speeches and the press conferences, do you think that there's a chance that quiet bipartisanship can happen behind the scenes, away from the cameras, that can help steer some legislation, not just to the floor, but ultimately to passage in this session?
Great bottom line question for what the next 6 months in America is going to bring, because at this politically toxic moment, there's no indication of that, but there's also no way around it. That has to happen. There are some Republicans who've tried to make clear that we're on a trajectory where we need bipartisanship to get the big things done, and we can do it sooner or we can do it later. But all of this has got to play itself out politically. And you've got a group of House Republicans who do not want to extend bipartisan ideas out there because, first of all, it's politically tricky for them with their constituents and the possibility of a Republican primary challenger if they do so. But also, they have this ongoing latent frustration of the past few years, watching Democrats pass things singularly, big things, without Republican votes, including the debt ceiling the last couple of times. And they have this sense that they should and need to do the same. Still a lot of bad blood from that January 6th committee. Other things too. Kimberly, they've got to get ironed out before they can really be bipartisan.
Scott McFarland is congressional correspondent for CBS News. Thank you for joining us. And Philip Wallach is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Philip, thank you for joining us too.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.